Hey, everybody. Today I wanted to air a now very famous sermon speech that I have given in Rockland, California, where reporters couldn't possibly believe that I spoke to 1,400 people in person, no social distancing, no masks. It's a great conversation. Please consider supporting us at charliekirk.com/support, which makes this conversation and so many like it possible. This conversation was actually done with my friend, Pastor Greg Farrington, from Rockland, California, at Destiny Church. You guys are going to love it. Great conversation. Now very popular and famous. Buckle up, everybody. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Is your home protected? There are more criminals on the loose than ever before, with the prisons being opened, and with police not being allowed to do their job. That's why you need SimpliSafe. SimpliSafe Home Security is having a massive Christmas sale. 40% off any SimpliSafe Home Security and a free security camera. Here's how it works. It won the CNET Editor's Choice Award for Home Security and was named the best of 2020 by Forbes and Popular Mechanics. The system has an arsenal of sensors and cameras that protect every inch of your home. You can set up yourself in about 30 minutes. It's really easy. Then SimpliSafe security specialists take over, monitoring your home around the clock, ready to send emergency help the moment there's an alarm. Get 40% off SimpliSafe plus a free security camera today by visiting simplisafe.com/charlie. Go today. The deal is this week only. That's simplisafe.com/charlie, simplisafe.com/charlie.
All right, so a little bit unscripted this time. We've done this twice. Mm-hmm. You said I could a little bit.
Any direction you want to go.
Any direction. This is really, really important to the Farrington household, mainly my daughter, my son, and myself. We're huge 49er fans.
Yes.
You went to school with Jimmy Garoppolo.
So I went to, I went to Wheeling High School. He went to Rolling Meadows. We actually trained in quarterback camp together.
Are you serious?
Yeah, so yeah, Jimmy is...
Somebody got a football?
So Jimmy's 2 years older than I am, and we knew the Garoppolo family growing up pretty well. His other brother worked for my father. But I was actually at the NFC, not the championship game, the divisional, but against the Vikings last year, supporting Jimmy. I have no inside information about Jimmy's recovery or any of that. So
Well, we need something. Can you send him a message? You got his cell phone number?
Well, I'll tell you a Jimmy Garoppolo story.
Okay.
And so Jimmy Garoppolo was a linebacker for Rolling Meadows High School up until his sophomore year, until a sequence of injuries, they started to realize this kid had amazing talent. So we went to the same quarterback coach, Jeff.
Wait a minute. He got injured in high school?
No, he didn't. But the other quarterbacks were getting injured. They said, hey, this kid has a bunch of talent. Maybe he'll be a good quarterback. And then he ended up going to the same football coach as I did. And we got to know each other. And he was no offers at all going into his senior year of high school. Ended up walking on at Eastern Illinois University, where Tony Romo and Sean Payton went. And he ended up becoming All-American by the time he was a senior. And obviously drafted by the Patriots and all that. But it's a pretty amazing story because he's probably one of the most successful NFL quarterbacks that was not recruited out of high school.
Yeah.
And incredible talent. And I remember being a sophomore in high school and he was a senior, and my dad turned to me because he made just an impossible play. He said, that kid's going to play in the NFL.
All right.
And he had that kind of talent. So hopefully things end up sorting itself out.
Could you send him, we're a church that believes in divine healing, and we'll pray for healing there. So if you want to send him a message on that. Well, that's good. See,
that was a surprise question.
That was a little surprise question for you, yes. Right there. There's some main and plain things that I do want us to talk about. One is, you know, as you heard, we've opened the doors for 26 weeks here, 6 months. You know, when they first say, hey, we got to flatten the curve, you know, so let's all be good team players. And we did that. But we said, hey, this is turning into 2 months and we got to get back to church. Biblical mandate, mm-hmm. First Amendment rights. To do that. So there's been pockets of this has happened across America. Pastors and churches that have said, we're going to stand, and they stood in this moment. But how come the rest of the churches and pastors aren't getting on board?
Yeah, it's a great question, isn't it? First of all, you have an amazing pastor here and a great church here. And for everyone watching online, a lot of the people that are watching online on our YouTube channel, they would be stunned to see that there were three services packed out of people here, because that's not the norm across the country, as you guys know, is that these actually, there's like one courageous pastor for every 100 miles, right, is what I found. Yep. And there's a couple in this state, Pastor Juergen in Awaken Church San Diego, Pastor Rob McCoy, Pastor James Cadiz. Mike McClure is amazing in Calvary Chapel, San Jose. He's up against massive fines for a similar, actually he has a much more adversarial county than here. Yeah. And so you guys have gone through a lot here, but what he's going through in Menlo Park, San Jose area is awful. Yeah. And so you asked, what is the reason? I've been trying to unpack that. And so I've been speaking at churches throughout the last 6 or 7 months all across the country. And when I started in June or July, you know, I was very much of kind of the grace-filled message, like, please open your church. You should be doing this. Look at the double standard. Look at how BLM Incorporated is able to riot and loot, you know, without any form of decency for the surroundings around them. The Los Angeles Lakers celebration was allowed to go straight through the streets of LA. No social distancing, no masks. Strip clubs are now allowed to be open in San Diego. Cannabis dispensaries remained open. Abortion clinics remained open. And as the months have gone on, I'm going to be very honest with you guys. My patience with pastors that have not opened their church is just gone. Yeah. And here's one of the main reasons. One of the main reasons is that there is a central planning, unbiblical component to keeping your church closed at this point. We know how the virus operates. We know who is most at risk. But opening up your church for voluntary gathering is insulting to your congregation. Here's why. It's you saying, I know what's best for every single person who's going to show up. See, all of you came here today making a voluntary choice, assessing the risk of you gathering. You know there's a chance. Of course you do. But you made the decision that I'm going to take the proper precautions. I might have already had it. How many people have here already had the virus? Okay, about 40 or 50. Now, I ask for a reason. Why should we continue to keep the country closed for you? I mean, you should be at least able to live, right? I mean, that's a good question, right? Now that we're 9 months into this thing, there's at least 5 or 6 million people that have known that they've had it. And so now we're keeping everything closed for you, even though you've been through that. And so there's this incredible kind of pride that comes in to me, to being able to say that I'm going to keep the church shut down because I'm such a good person and I don't want to contribute to the spread. I say, well, first of all, it's not a victimless action. When you keep the church closed, depression goes up, lack of social contact, suicide, mental health issues, marital issues. They took Easter from us, which is the number one gathering of believers every single year, and where churches really get to expand their membership and expose the church to people that only go to church on Christmas and Easter. And the other part of this where pastors, I think, they're really kind of in this handcuff where they are afraid to go against the predominant culture. And the church is always supposed to be disagreeable by nature. The church exists to say no to a secular, humanist, indulgent culture. That's why the church exists. And so the moment when Christianity becomes within the predominant political viewpoint or the predominant cultural tendencies of Hollywood or the tech companies, we should take pause and say, wait a second, is that really, really congruent with what the Bible is teaching? And the answer is no. And they hide behind this really sloppy reading of Romans 13, which says to submit to all rulers of authority, and it goes on to and say, unless there is tyranny in some form or fashion. But let's play that out. Who is the ruler of authority in our country? And you might say it's Gavin Newsom. Yeah. But you might say it's a congressman or a city council member. Under a constitutional republic, if we are to read Romans 13 as it is written, we're actually in charge. We're the sovereign.
Good.
And so,
that's good.
To use a sloppy interpretation of Romans 13, let's even take their argument at face value. They say, submit to all leaders of authority. What are we supposed to submit to then? Submit to a government that respects your natural rights. If that government then starts to violate your natural rights, that compact is broken. Yeah. All of a sudden, that voluntary compact that we have with that government that sort of contract that we have has been invalidated, especially when those rulers and those leaders violate the rules themselves. So when Gavin Newsom goes to French Laundry and you can't go to church, stop listening to Gavin Newsom.
Yeah. This group is pretty loose.
No, it's great. This will be the longest one we've had.
Yeah, here we are. The government kicks the doors of the church down. They're inside the church now, and we got, because they use COVID as their way into controlling our behavior. So they don't want us to meet. So they use something to say, "Hey, you can't meet." You mentioned this first service. Doesn't it take some people in culture to defy the civic government at some point in time to maintain their rights that are given to them?
Yeah, absolutely. And so some of the Christian pastors that I disagree with that are just totally wrong, and many of whom are cowards, and I say that, I don't say that lightly, I don't. They have no courage to their convictions whatsoever. They just want bigger budgets and bigger buildings and maybe some baptisms as well, the three B's that drive most of Christian Incorporated in this country. It's true. And, if they had 10% less people showing up, yet 100% more truth, they would consider that to be an awful thing. And when people leave churches, they're like, "I'm leaving." I'm like, "Yeah, don't worry. There's way too much truth there probably for you, right? It's like way too much." And so people say, they'll say, "Well, I want separation of church and state." First of all, that's not in the Constitution. It's not. It's in a singular letter that Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptist Convention. But okay, you want separation of church and state. Yeah, I want the state to stay out of my church.
There you go.
Okay, I want, let's take that argument. I want the California public health officials to say, "You know what? No, you don't have the right to come in here." So religious expression is clearly protected by two clauses in the First Amendment, the Free Expression Clause and the Establishment Clause. It is the only thing that we have in our country that is explicitly protected by two separate clauses. And yet we have decided in the last 6 months to completely abandon the terrain of interfacing on how important the church is. Activist Christians built this country. It's a verifiable fact. Pastors from the Pupils of America built the philosophical and moral framework that started the greatest country ever to exist in the history of the world. The three awakenings that followed, the four total great awakenings, continued the American experiment through many sorts of seasons of up and down. And so there's many examples in the Old Testament and the New Testament of defying tyrannical authority. This sort of theological revisionism that has now seeped its way into even some seminaries that teach a lot of youth pastors across the country around the only interpretation of Romans 13 that I already have kind of picked apart is really dangerous. So how is a pastor who remains closed supposed to make sense of the story of Daniel when there was an order that was a conspiracy against Daniel, right? It was a conspiracy. They went up to the king, and there was a couple kings he served. I think it was Nebuchadnezzar, but I could be wrong. He was a counselor to multiple kings, but I think it was Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 6, where the king was convinced by bad actors to put forth an order that said, if you follow the rabbinical laws and if you follow the laws of prayer, then you will be put in prison. And they wanted to go after Daniel. This was a true conspiracy, right? The definition of a conspiracy. So Daniel in like 6:11 or 12, I might be off by a couple of verses. It says so clearly, Daniel heard the order.
Yeah.
He understood the order. And then he made a conscious decision to defy the order. Now, he didn't defy it in private. He didn't defy it by going into a corner and praying. He went to his home, opened up the window towards the city, and prayed towards the city saying, "You're going to have to watch me pray and you're going to have to come arrest me because God will deliver me." Now, that is a direct act of civil disobedience of the rulers. Why did he do it? Because it violated God's commandments. That's why. If it was some sort of inconsequential rule, right, then Daniel probably wouldn't have taken that kind of dramatic action. But as soon as it started to violate God's commandments, such as the assembly of believers, the worshiping of an almighty and a loving God, then Daniel said, "You're going to have to come arrest me and all that. I'm going to do it so you know that I'm doing it." And that's a very important part of civil disobedience, right? And Daniel is the ultimate example of biblical civil disobedience. He didn't flee. He didn't try to evade arrest. He said, I'm going to take responsibility for violating your stupid rule. Now, this is a very important thing, and you lived this out as a courageous pastor. You said on Pentecost, you're going to have to arrest me. And they ended up not,
right,
because a lot of their threats are baseless, and they're cowards, and they actually don't want the conflict. But what you look at that biblical example of Daniel, we can also look in the first part of Exodus at the midwives that saved Moses by defying the orders of, you know, terminating or killing the firstborn children. No Moses if that was not
absolutely
violated. Why? Well, that's against God's commandments, right? Thou shalt, I mean, and the Ten Commandments weren't even actually necessarily communicated yet, but it was pretty well, you know, it was pretty well known that murder was not looked favorably in the eyes of God. What's the point I'm getting at here is that there are multiple examples of God's people prayerfully, carefully, but yet publicly defying tyrannical orders. And we must do that in this season. Let me be very clear. This is one of those seasons. Black Friday, Cyber Monday, one day only sale. Wouldn't you rather just work with a company who puts you on a pedestal every day? That's what you get with PeerTalk, a veteran-run wireless company who understands what it means to serve. Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile. If you're with them, you're overpaying pure and simple. PeerTalk can easily save you over $400 a year. Listen, this is all you need. Unlimited talk, text, and 2 gigs of data for just $20 a month. And if you go over on data usage, they don't charge you for it. What a novelty, a company that actually puts their customers first. Switching to PeerTalk is the easiest decision you'll make today. You can keep your phone and your phone number or get great deals on your latest iPhone or Androids. Grab your mobile phone and dial #250 and say Charlie Kirk. When you do, you'll save 50% off your first month. Dial #250 and say keyword Charlie Kirk. PeerTalk, simply smarter wireless.
And this is not something that we come to lightly. If you are going to defy a government order, it should not be haphazardly. It should be done so prayerfully. You should fast. However, if you come to the conclusion to defy, then you must go all the way through.
Amen.
That means that's right. I am going to accept the punishment. This is what Henry David Thoreau and it's either Emerson or Thoreau. I get the two interchanged. They're both at the same time. But Martin Luther King talked about, which is that if you're going to disobey, you have to be willing to then serve the prison sentence. And Daniel was the biblical inspiration for this.
Right.
And so where we are right now with the church in America is they're trying to see how far they can actually push us. This is a social experiment, and we are failing miserably. And basically what the tyrants and the autocrats, the politicians and the bureaucrats have learned is that the American church will do exactly what we tell them to do. There might be a couple disagreeable bunches here, but when they come through and they say that your child cannot go to school without a mandatory vaccination, they know most churches will agree to it. They know that because we haven't opened our doors now. And that's where this comes in, where we are now in a season where we know how this virus operates. We know the human cost of the lockdowns. We know the erosion of private property. We know people's life savings that have vanished. Now is the greatest clarion call for a mass civil disobedience against these autocrats and these tyrants. But we must be willing to pay the price. It's very important.
It's funny. When we decided to open up the church, it was actually the time that we got on the front page of the Bee in July. And I told my wife before I came to church, because there were people who were threatening us. They're going to block our streets, all that stuff. And I said, well, this is what we're going to do. As soon as they arrest me, you're going to take everybody outside. You're going to have a protest outside. But you're going to send two of my best friends to get me out of jail. We had a plan.
What I love about it is that you were not planning to get in a getaway car or to abdicate it to somebody else or blame somebody else. So you deserve a lot of credit for that, because you have an infinite amount more courage than the entire combined body of most pastors in this country. And I mean that.
Thank you. Thank you. So let me pivot. Here's a question you
sure
don't know I was going to ask.
Okay.
But you mentioned it in my office. There's a, you know, because people have been saying, hey, the virus is going to go away after the election. Well, it didn't. The fear just got higher, right? I think the media pivoted to that. And so now there's the hope of the vaccine. What do you think about the vaccine?
I mean, look, I'm not going to take it. Let me be very clear. And if there's someone here that is, and they feel that the data analysis they do warrants them taking it, then okay, that's what liberty is all about, right? Is that you can make informed decisions. I'm not going to ridicule anyone. I'm not going to say I have any sort of inside information against it or for it. What I am going to say is that I have the personal agency not to take something that is suspiciously rushed to market, where they are now in a very totalitarian way, forced, almost previewing force to say that you must take this in order to get your children here or get jobs or all that. That raises alarm bells for me. Let me be very clear. And so I want everyone to do their own independent research of people that you trust and dive deep into it, and then you come to your own conclusions. What really bothers me, though, about that entire conversation is how they are now going to use this as a social check mechanism of whether or not your children can live the same sort of life as those that decide to do it. And that's a very dangerous thing. Where all of a sudden that we believe so firmly in this rush to market vaccination that still we have not seen the data on it. We have not seen the clinical trials. We have not seen any of that, where we must take it for whatever reason that they're pushing it. And there's a profit incentive behind it. Of course there is. There are people that are going to make a tremendous amount of money behind this. And here's also where I land on just the issue of the election being the end of kind of the virus, or at least the fear mongering around it. President Trump, and I was one, I also said this as well, that as soon as after the election, they were going to open up the country. And I was wrong in saying that. I should have known better, because the real intentions behind the virus is to use it as a fear mongering tactic. And it is a real virus. You take proper precautions, but they're using it to now be able to accomplish prior held and deeply held political objectives, right? So they did it to try and destroy Donald Trump. They did it to try and blame him for it. And now that it's over, the political side of it has kind of now gone away. So now they can do what they really want to do. And that's not to open up the country and get back to how things used to be. Now what they really want to do is the Great Reset, which is what's coming in 2021 at the Davos meeting. You guys can look it up yourself, of the World Economic Forum, where they want to abolish private property. They want to get rid of fossil fuels. They want to empower and embolden the pharmaceutical companies. And they have now said, and Justin Trudeau said this, who he on one of his Zoom or Skype calls that he did with foreign leaders, Justin Trudeau said, this presents in a once-in-a-generation opportunity to be able to fundamentally transform our countries. And that's what they're doing. And so now you're seeing Gavin Newsom and J.B. Pritzker and Andrew Cuomo intensify the lockdowns. Why? Well, it's not to defeat the president. It's actually not, because now there's no electoral safeguard. The reason they didn't do this in October is actually because lockdowns are super unpopular. It's actually they started to see themselves pay a political price to these lockdowns. Now that there's no election to actually be as a check and balance against it, they have a completely different reason. They want to crush you. That's why. Yeah. They want to make your savings disappear. They want to make your businesses evaporate. They want to make your children be chemically addicted to whatever substance they have to take now to not be depressed. And so they're just going to try to wait this thing out enough to suffocate our entire civilization. That's their agenda now. Yeah. And by the way, none of this is theorizing. Just look at what they say. They all have said this publicly, all of them. Mayor Eric Garcetti and Lori Lightfoot, they say, now we can really, you know, tackle climate change. Now we can pass universal basic income. Now we can do Medicare for all. Now we can do all these things that we've wanted to do. So you have a pathological sociopathic group of people that have these deeply held political convictions prior to the virus. The virus comes. They get this anti-scientific notion of shutting everything down, which has never worked before. It's the dumbest epidemiological idea ever, which is to quarantine the healthy and then make the sick and the vulnerable have more people that are infected. So let me get this straight. We put infected people in nursing homes and we closed our schools. Like, what on earth was that all about? Yeah. And then we keep the most productive, least likely to die people, which are young people between the ages of 18 to 30, sheltered in place so they can amass massive debt loads, stay out of the economic force, get high levels of depression, not get married, not have kids. They make perfect revolutionaries, by the way. Of course, they're going to burn down the country around you. They haven't done anything for 6 months because you shut down their country. Of course they're going to burn everything down. And so the only solution to this is the sequence, the rate that this is going is they're going to try to lock us down worse than they did in March and April at this point. Just look, everything happens in Europe is a preview to happen here, right? Because they're trying to create this globalist coalition where there is no difference between countries. So when Merkel, Macron, and Boris Johnson lock down for 60 days, like total lockdown, that's coming here next. Don't be surprised. Why are they doing it? Because there's no penalty to pay at the ballot box anymore. That's why. It's because elections are over outside of the Georgia runoff, and they've already suffered consequences because of it. Republicans flipped 3 state legislators, won 28 out of 28 congressional races. We won Senate races. The lockdowns ended up being unbelievably unpopular. And so now they see this as their chance to go for the jugular. They want to create a crisis so bad that only a massive government could come in and promise to save it.
Yeah.
They want everyone to all of a sudden say, I'm in so much suffering, I have no other choice. And unless we have tens of millions of people demanding and living out the reopening of our country, they're going to get what they want. Yeah.
So my wife says this, we're one nation under God, not one nation under government. That's who we are as a people. We're under God. So you mentioned we had an election, right? Or no, we haven't had an election yet, but we're unsure a lot of things. I'm not the smartest guy in the room, but I'm not the dumbest. I'm just kind of looking at all the trends, which you've already rehearsed. Donald Trump won this election. He won the election.
Very clear. And look, so let's just look at non-Trump data and then let's connect it together. How is it that President Trump did better than any Republican with blacks and Hispanics since 1960? He won West Texas. He won the Rio Grande Valley that a Republican has not won since 1906. President Trump won Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
Okay? President Trump did unbelievably well in areas that Republicans have never, ever done well. Republicans won 28 out of 28 House seats. Republicans were supposed to lose up and down California. Michelle Steele and Young Kim have won in Orange County. Mike Garcia is knocking on the door. It's within 50 to 100 votes, but he actually might pull it out. And polling said there was no way that he was going to be able to survive that. Republicans flipped a deeply Democrat seat in downtown Miami with Elvira Salazar, who speaks fluent Spanish, former communist refugee. So she was in Cuban communism and fled. An incredible story, and she won by 3 points. Trump did 17 points better in Miami-Dade County. And so Trump did better, 5 points better in Chicago, 1 point better in Washington, D.C. He did better everywhere, except the 4 cities that stopped counting on election night. And so before I proceed any further, let's just look at this completely rationally and logically, outside of all the filters of what you see on television, because they're all lying to you, okay? And I don't say that lightly. You're being lied to. And just looking at this very rationally, and some of you might say there's no widespread evidence, there's no evidence widespread of voter fraud. Okay, let's just put that aside. And then how can anyone possibly say in any sort of human exercise where there's 170 million participants and the prize is a $4 trillion government for 4 years, control of the U.S. armed forces, the intelligence agencies, and ultimate power, that we're supposed to believe that no one's going to cheat in that exercise when 170 million people are participating? People cheat playing Monopoly, okay? People cheat at poker. People cheat on taxes. People cheat driving to church. I'm sure one of you cheated by running a red light or disobeying a stop sign or a U-turn you weren't supposed to do. We are programmed to make things better in our image. That's called sin, distance from God.
Right.
And so we're supposed to believe that we have evidence of a multi-trillion dollar money laundering industry that exists in our country, child sex trafficking industry, of a drug trafficking industry. We know organized crime hits every portion of America, everything. We have millions of prisoners. We could go on endlessly of the types of problems we have. But the one thing that operates perfectly and seamlessly, with no corruption, no questions, is our voting system. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. They then say, and that's just looking at it logically and rationally, they say there's no evidence of widespread voter fraud. So first of all,
That's an objective and a subjective term, right? So it's kind of linguistic jiu-jitsu they're playing with you. How do you define widespread? You ever think about that? It's a completely subjective term, right? So one person might say widespread is 1%. Some person might say widespread is 5%. 1% Trump's president. So all of a sudden, they say it's not widespread. Well, okay, 1% wouldn't be widespread. It's enough to determine the presidency. Do you see all of a sudden they're playing games and they're lying to you? And they say there's no evidence. Okay, if all of us went into the Sacramento area to restaurants and to laundromats the next couple of days, you wouldn't see any evidence of money laundering until you were able to get the FBI or authorities involved, look through people's bank statements, see who's coming in with piles of cash, and all of a sudden you'd see who actually might who's trying to clean dollar bills in your local area. What's the point? Some of the stuff hides itself really well. That's what organized crime does. And you don't have massive amount of criminal units looking into it. They're going to keep on doing it. And so when you start to see these massive national trends and four outliers that happen to be the most four deciding state, you know, counties and cities in the states that matter, then we have to call time out and ask really what's happening. And so we've been looking into this. We've been doing more research on our program and our podcast than almost any out there. So I'm just going to give you some numbers. I want everyone to think about this. Thank you. I want you to think about this really rationally, right? And so, and by the way, we know what they are willing to do. And I want to be very clear. And I say this with no kidding whatsoever. If I thought Benito Mussolini was in the White House, I would cheat. And I would be able to justify it under a Christian ethic. I would. If I thought that Adolf Hitler was in the White House, I would cheat in the election. I would. Because I would. That's what they've convinced themselves of. They have convinced themselves that that is actually a reincarnation of 1930s Germany. It's a sick lie. But there are 30 million people that believe that. So think what they would be willing to do, what you would be willing to do if you were counting votes in 1930s Germany. What would you do? You'd probably throw away some votes for that one party, wouldn't you? Because you would know, you would think that you would know. That's actually the pathological obsession that these people have. And so all of a sudden, this idea of fraud becomes a lot more palatable. Like, wow, okay. So here's one example that I can use, and I could go endlessly with this. Explain to me, anyone in the media, please offer me an explanation. Why in Pennsylvania, there was a 1,774% increase of voter registration for 90-plus-year-olds in the midst of a pandemic within 90 days? No, that's a really simple, easy question, right? Why is it that there was a bum rush of 90-plus-year-olds in the midst of a pandemic, the likes of which we've never seen, to go register to vote? Why is it most of those lived in places where other voters are registered to vote? Those are mostly nursing homes or living centers. Well, an easy answer would be a practice that has been exposed before by certain agencies when a little bit of investigation is done. It's called granny farming. It's a term that the New York Times came up with, which is the intercepting and filling out of ballots of people that are at risk and they actually don't receive the ballots themselves. Just 2 days ago, a woman named Susan at a developmentally disabled clinic in downtown Milwaukee said she started to do Zoom interviews with all of her patients because of the virus, she's not able to go in. 20 of them said that they wanted to vote for Trump, but the person who came in filled out the ballot for them for Biden and they were able to do nothing. Can you think of anything more sick or evil than going to developmentally disabled patients and then exerting your political will against their choice? That is an evil that I don't even want to touch right now. But again, if they think the person in office is an evil person, they're justifying their own behavior. And so there's an infinite amount of data I could go with this stuff. So it's Dane County, Wisconsin. Let's just use this. Anyone know Dane County, Wisconsin? Maybe, maybe not. Okay. So Dane County, Wisconsin is where the University of Wisconsin-Madison is. Okay. It's the largest school in the state of Wisconsin. When Barack Obama visited in 2012, he had 45,000 people. I think we'll all agree that Obama, for all of his flaws, that was a real political movement. People supported him. They had signage. They had enthusiasm. They had energy. There was a kinetic energy to Barack Obama, right? People were talking about it. It was kitchen table conversation. There was a real velocity behind the Obama movement, right? Not one that I would philosophically subscribe to, but I believed it when he won. Like, I bought it. I said, okay, there's support here. It is inexplicable to me that Joe Biden, while the campus of University of Wisconsin-Madison is closed, it's a ghost town, managed to get 65,000 more votes than Barack Obama did in that same county. I don't believe it. And I want someone to prove how that's possible. Joe Biden, who said he had no ground game, no canvassers whatsoever.
Now, the only explanation is because of vote by mail. Is vote by mail because everyone got a ballot, all of a sudden expanded turnout, and therefore it expanded Joe Biden's reach. Jimmy Carter himself said that vote by mail is the most unsecure, open to fraud method of voting. Of course it is. You don't know who's actually filling out that ballot. And you guys know all too well ballot harvesting here in the state of California, what it can do to an election. And even with ballot harvesting, you guys did unbelievably well in some of these elections here in California. And so the suppression of anyone that mentions this stuff is also a tell that we're onto something. How aggressive they are coming after me for just asking questions shows me that there's something to this, whether it be in Dominion voting systems or Hammer and Scorecard or in Smartmatic or whatever it is. There are open-ended questions that we deserve answers to, because here's the consequence. The consequence is that if they do what they typically do, which is that sit down and shut up, you're a racist, he's going to be president, then 70 million people are no longer going to trust the system. And while that might be something that could benefit us politically in the short term, it's a really bad thing for the country. It just is. And so what happened in my working theory is this, and this is my exclusive theory, is that on Saturday before the election, the Biden campaign and the Democrats had to resort to plan B and plan C. Their initial plan was to win in a legitimate blue wave landslide styled after Obama in 2008 and 2012, where they would win Senate races in Montana, Iowa. That any fraud that was done would be covered up by a massive Nancy Pelosi expansion. But the Saturday before the election, they started to see what I saw, which was the Democrat polling was collapsing faster than the Maginot Line in World War II. I mean, it was the French way that just surrender, right? It was collapsing in real time. And it was happening so quickly, because a lot of you know this in your life, you know people, the late breakers all went for Trump. Married women went for Trump in a way the polling would never have expected. 6 points above the polling, right? Where all of a sudden, decent Americans were like, I don't like his style, but he's far better than Biden. And it was happening, and the Democrats didn't know what to do. And it's my working theory, and I think I can prove it. I don't know if I'd be able to prove it in front of a judge, because it's just that threshold of evidence is, I don't have subpoena power, right? But I could prove it to all of you, is that they went to plan B, which is the Chicagoization of American politics. Which is, we are not going to submit our election results on election night. We are going to take days. We are going to sort. We are going to cut corners. And all of a sudden, we're going to slow down the process. Have you ever lived through an election where it takes them 5 days to count ballots? Where all of a sudden, it's this all-week banana republic-style affair of just like these slow trickle of ballots. And the reason I believe is this, is that if all the ballots were demanded to be counted on election night, I think President Trump would have won. I really do. And so this is an old Chicago tactic, right? Just figure out how many votes you need and compensate the difference with all the ballot laundering and the absentee rejection fraud. And so here's a really simple example, a numerical example. Just think about this logically. Just strip yourself of any bias you have for Trump or whatever. Georgia had 260,000 mail-in ballots in 2016. They had 1.3 million this election cycle. What guarantees were we given that they were prepared to process 1.3 million ballots correctly and verify all those signatures and check for fraud? In 2016, 4% of all mail-in ballots were rejected for many different reasons. Less than half of 1% was rejected this election in Georgia. Because and they weren't prepared for that kind of onslaught of mail-in ballots. And so that opens up for people that are filling in two ballots. They're out of state. They're filling it in for friends. And you might say, well, it's not widespread. 1% of 1.3 million is a very big number.
Yeah.
In fact, that's close to the number it would take. 4% of that number is about 40,000. That would be enough for President Donald Trump to now be considered the winner in Georgia. And so I know that I'm going on about this, but I think you guys are very interested in this, that this was without a doubt not their primary plan. And I think that if we can finally get the Federal Bureau of Investigation or the Department of Justice involved, which I don't know where they are, and I'm not trying to make you upset, but just think about this for a second. Bubba Wallace, the NASCAR driver, claims that his rope on his garage is a noose. Okay.
And again, it wasn't as bad as Jussie Smollett. He didn't plant it there, but he gives this whole diatribe about how it's a noose and he knows a noose when he sees one, and only a black person can know what a noose looks like, which is the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. Like, everyone knows what a noose looks like and we know what a garage thing is, okay? The FBI sent 13 agents to go investigate that overnight. Remember? 13 agents, like instantaneously. And they determined that it was a garage rope and it wasn't a noose, and all of that was just kind of drum up controversy. Where are the FBI agents flooding these urban areas and just asking questions?
Yeah.
Where are they? And it's as if there's this line that they're not allowed to cross because they're afraid of being called bad names. And I am confident, in fact, I'm certain that if any form of investigation was given into these cities, that there would be an organized criminal racket. And let me just say one other thing. People say there's no evidence, it's not true. What if I told you 10 years ago that there'd be 89,000 people that would step up and say they were sexually assaulted in the Boy Scouts? Would you believe me? No. You'd say, no way. They would have spoke out. Well, that's what came out last week. What if I told you in the 1960s that there were 600 Catholic priests that were molesting children? You'd say, that's heresy, shut up. Ended up being true. You don't find something until you look into it. Yeah. And when you have suspicion of something, especially something evil, you have a moral obligation to look into it. Good. Top Resume is the world's number one authority on resume writing. How many of you are saying, I just want a job, but I just keep on getting rejected? Well, I could tell you, as someone who employs hundreds and hundreds of people and someone who has actually rejected thousands and thousands of more, a resume makes a really big difference. So get serious about this. Recruiters and other hiring managers, such as myself, lean on tech solutions to scan resumes for picks. Do you know that a resume can make or break your entire career? So who do you turn for feedback on your resume? Some people turn to their parents and maybe their grandparents. That's fine. But how about resume experts? Go to the pros to get the job done right. Don't leave it to chance. Let the experts at Top Resume work with you to create a job-winning resume that gets noticed. Find out how your resume stacks up. Go to topresume.com/Kirk to get a free resume review. It's as simple as uploading your resume to their site, and you'll get a free evaluation and expert advice on how to make it stronger. Top Resume is also giving my listeners 15% off their professional resume writing services. So go to topresume.com/Kirk today for your comprehensive resume review and 15% off resume writing services if you want to work with a pro. That's topresume.com/Kirk. TopResume.com/Kirk. Get a job at TopResume.com/Kirk. It'll make that easier.
Church and politics. I was, called a bunch of names by people outside the church, inside the church, that I was too political. My viewpoint is everything's political. But at this point, what does the church do? What are the action steps that we take? Because we're fired up here. We want to do something. What do we do?
So there's a verse in 1 Timothy that says, pray for all leaders and authorities so they might live quiet and peaceable lives. And I asked this question of churches, and I would imagine this church would be able to answer it better, is, do you know the names of every single school board member and city council member, and are you praying for them by name and the issues that they're dealing with? And most churches can say no. And they just say no. I don't. And I think that churches need to begin to dominate local government. I think that local races are so unbelievably important, and they just get looked over. County supervisor races, recorder races, and they're usually on like a Tuesday in March in an off year. But they sometimes are the most consequential races to determining education and even whether or not you're going to have the California Department of Health showing up. A lot of those are results of local races. And so I will say this, what is the church supposed to do? The church needs to get more political, not less political. As I mentioned, all throughout the Old Testament, there are examples of God's people trying to influence secular government. Daniel, Joseph, Nehemiah, Jeremiah, Esther, Mordecai, there's limitless examples. And so if a church says we don't want to be a political church, ironically, that's already a political statement, right? So whether you say you're political or we're not political or politically left or political right, no matter what you do, you're making a political statement. So just make the correct one is the next choice to make.
And then the other thing is that we are going to have to take account and responsibility for what we have been given. And this is reflected in the parable of the talents. And I believe that one of the gifts that we have been given is America. Yeah. And so I believe that in the parable of the talents, for those of you that don't know, is basically a parable of an owner or someone in charge that distributes talents or currency to three different people. And they all get different amounts and they all decide to do something different with it. The person who gets the least amount ends up not multiplying it at all and putting it under a rock. The person who gets an intermediate amount multiplies it slightly, but the person who gets a lot multiplies it greatly and gets blessed tremendously in the eyes of Jesus telling the story. And the person who does nothing, it's one of the harshest actual sentences we have from Jesus on record, which is basically you're going to burn forever in the gnashing of the teeth. I think we're actually going to have to take account for blessings that we're given. And I actually think that we as Americans, when we face judgment, I think we are going to have a lot of explaining to do if we just decided to say that this country founded by Christians on biblical ideas that has been more equitable, more benevolent, more creative, and more generous than any other country ever, we decided it didn't matter if it disintegrated. I think that we're going to actually face judgment for that. Because this experiment that we have is the greatest country ever to exist in the history of the world. And it has lifted more people out of poverty, given more people opportunity, given more charity around the world, been a better example for these biblical ideas. And so the church in Jeremiah, it says, care for the welfare of the nation that you're in. We should care greatly of the direction the country is going in. And so action steps are as this. Number one, obviously the civic and local races, platform candidates that are around biblical ideas and support them. And the other thing is this, and this is an unusual thing that I tell people, but is go crazy about learning. The greatest thing that the thing that the Christian community doesn't do enough of is learn the political landscape that we're in. And I'm starting to see this happen more, I have to say. Start to read the literature that drives the left. Know who Saul Alinsky is. Go read Rules for Radicals. Go read what your children are learning. Go understand what the 1619 Project is. Go read the political philosophy that was inspired by Christianity that built America from Edmund Burke, from Thomas Paine to John Locke to Socrates to Plato and Aristotle. And what I have found about Bible-believing Christians, especially Christians in a church like this, is that you're not afraid to learn. A lot of you have Bible commentaries and you listen, you go deep into the original Greek and Hebrew. That's awesome. So let's do a little bit of learning now on the political landscape, because learning is always the first step to a revival. And a lot of your questions, let me be very clear, a lot of your questions of what do I do will answer itself the deeper you get into the texts, the deeper you get into the pursuit of truth, all of a sudden the answers will present itself. Like, oh my gosh, yes, of course I should do that. And so I want a knowledgeable Christian political community. I want a Christian community that knows the literature of the left better than their activists do. I want to see a Christian church that knows exactly where natural rights come from, that knows the writings of Aquinas versus Augustine. And if a lot of this stuff is just all a bunch of word salad to you, that's okay, because we never had to do this before. You know why? Because we were reaping the benefits of Christian sacrifices many generations ago. We don't have that luxury anymore.
Two questions. First is this, and I think it's important for our church to hear this. You made a recommendation to me in my office. We have all kinds of different ministries here. We're a large church, youth, college, young marrieds, active adults, bunch. Who do you think we ought to hire here?
I think that every church needs a political civic pastor coordinator that at least once a week or once a month has a civics night where people can come and ask really good questions that things you're wrestling with. And because with the over political nature of our country, I'm sure a lot of people in this room have questions that you guys are wrestling with that you see on social media where people say, how can you be a Christian and support Trump? How can you be a Christian and want to take people's health care away? You're only pro-birth. You're not pro-life. I'm sure you guys hear this in one way or the other on social media. See a lot of these heads being nodded? So then what's the church doing to gather you guys on Wednesday or Thursday nights? The same way that you would gather young singles and tell them how to marry biblically. The same way on Tuesday nights you would have the young financial planning group, right? How to get yourself out of bankruptcy. it's not insignificant when people wrestle with these political issues because it sometimes possesses you, right? Like maybe everything I believe politically is wrong, or maybe it is, maybe it isn't. And then you gather that. And so I think that every church across the country should put on their payroll someone that is designated as the civic and governmental and political pastor, where people in that church can seek out that person, in email, phone call, text, and weekly gatherings around these issues of how am I supposed to interact with civic government with the Bible? And if you have confusion, that's okay. That's what that person should be there for. And what I have found, and I know that you're already interested in doing this, organically, you kind of, independently, I should say, we kind of came to this idea, is that as soon as you start to satisfy the flock around some of these answers, you will be stunned to see the church continue to grow and also deepen in its commitment to faith. Because when you have, especially with young people, and when you have 18, 19, and 20-year-olds that are on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube all day long, and they're hearing nothing about transgender, BLM incorporated, moral relativism stuff, and they come back to the church and they ask a pastor, hey, what am I supposed to make sense of this? And they say, oh, no, we don't touch this. Well, then they're not going to come ask you for marriage advice either. Okay, they're not going to come ask you for other important advice because they value that. That's a really important thing. They're trying to, can you help make sense of this? Because there's this 6-minute video about reparations and it kind of feels good. And shouldn't we as Christians give reparations away? And if a pastor doesn't know exactly how to answer that, or they just say, we don't do that, then they're going to feel dismissed and they'll go seek somebody who is going to go answer them. And that person probably isn't rooted in biblical truth. And so I think that's a really important step for every church to take across the country.
Okay. So I don't believe that God is done with America. Amen. I believe that there's a call, anointing, a specific thing that God helped this nation to be birthed. I don't believe that God is done with it. Amen. Can you, we've talked about a lot of the challenging stuff that's in front of our nation. Can you just give these people some hope in
yes.
this moment?
So I'll do it in 2.5 minutes if I can. If you're like me, you look at the landscape and you say, there are zero powerful institutions I trust. If you're like me, you look at the news networks that many of us used to trust, the papers we used to read, the companies we bought stuff from, the colleges we sent our kids to, or your friends went to college to, or the Christian pastors you once followed, and you say, there's very little I trust anymore. If you're like me, that's how I feel. That is if this, the year of 2020, I think has become the post-institutional year, where institutions that once had such authority over our lives have been crumbling and almost like Genesis 11, just absolutely being scattered, and it's happening quickly. So on the appearance, that's a really depressing thing. It's actually unbelievably exciting because now it's this barren landscape where new things can be built, where all of a sudden we as Christians, I think, have a call to action to do three things, build, support, defend. So to build new things, to build bigger institutions, to expand churches that are doing the things the right way, to go deeper into all of that, to build families, to build new stuff. And that is what we are called to do as Christians. It's a uniquely Christian idea, which is to go forward into the unknown, into the barren, and erect something new. That is a Christian idea, right? And that's something we don't talk about enough, where it's Christianity is not about destruction. It's not about any of that. It's about, that's why the pilgrims literally called themselves pilgrims, even though they went the opposite direction of Israel. Like, what? They were going to nothing because they knew out of nothing something could be created if you follow God's law. Again, that's a longer speech I could give for a different time. However, build, support. I'm going to challenge all of you here. Don't ever, on social media or internet, indulge in a pattern of behavior where you're looking for the next failure. Do you notice how there's this irresistible appetite from the media and from the people who process media to wait for the downfall of the next person? The next podcaster, you know, the next Christian pastor, the next business tycoon. We just can't wait for the inevitable fall, right? What are we doing to actually support the good guys? What are we doing to go out of our way to say, you know what? I know that they're going to try to be attacked by the media. I know that they're going to send investigative reporters after them. I know they're going to be all these sorts of different things. I want to kind of prop up the good guys because they're going to be out of attack. They're going to be under attack because every time we see a pattern of success in our country, all of a sudden there is this massive, nasty, venomous internet culture that takes over, ridicules, mocks that person, and tries to take them down. And again, I participate against, that happens to me every day. I'm not saying it's about me, but I'm saying that it could be really exhausting when you feel as if even people that are supposed to be on your team are kind of like, yeah, I kind of want to see him cut down because he's a little too high for me. Like, enough of that. Let's support the good guys. They're not going to be perfect, but they'll be good. And the final thing is let's go. And I said, build, support, defend. And the defend is the other part of it, which is, here's the optimistic message, is that as the laws of gravity are now caving in on higher education, college, tech companies, big corporations, media institutions, all of it, then what a great opportunity to build something new. And that's where we have to lean in and say that this is going to be our greatest moment, where people are going to be seeking truth, seeking courage, because it is so unbelievably rare right now. And it's going to be tough. It's going to be difficult. But I believe that America's best times could be ahead of us if we look at this as a new building moment, the same way the pilgrims did this very week many hundreds of years ago, where we're going to the new Jerusalem to go build something new with God's law and to be able to really fulfill his purpose here on earth and in this country. And with that, I believe our best days are ahead.
Amen.
Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Please consider getting involved with Turning Point USA, where we play offense with a sense of urgency to win America's culture war at tpusa.com, tpusa.com. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. God bless. Speak to you soon.